history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, eye-opening stories, inspiring stories, amazing stories just waiting to be told. All we need to do is ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Something unique happened in this past week that maybe you heard about on the news, but I wanted to make sure to emphasize it on the program this week because the man who inspired it made a big impression on me, and I'm sure on many of you listening right now. A 400-mile funeral procession took the body of USS Arizona survivor Don Stratton from Colorado Springs, where he spent his final years, through Kansas and all the way to Red Cloud, Nebraska, where he was born. His flag-draped casket arrived on March 2nd, which was dubbed Don Stratton Day in his hometown. A bridge on Interstate 25 in Colorado Springs is named after him as well. And we only have an hour on the radio, so we can't catalog all the honors that he received, but Mr. Stratton's passing on February 15th leaves just two surviving members now of the Arizona's crew from December 7th, 1941. Perhaps you've read Don's best-selling book, All the Gallant Men, which his family hopes will turn into a feature film someday. Or maybe you've seen one of the countless interviews he gave in an effort to honor the nearly 1,200 shipmates he lost at Pearl Harbor. We were fortunate to have one of those interviews on Hometown Heroes, and we're going to hear some of that today. But we're also going to hear some of the tributes to Don from his memorial service in Colorado Springs. You'll hear references to the basic elements of his remarkable story in his own humble telling, and also from those who admired him so. The majority of his body was burned when the Arizona was hit. He had no fingerprints for the final 78 years of his life as a result, and he wouldn't have made it off the ship alive except for a seaman on a neighboring ship who disobeyed a direct order and tossed a lifeline that saved Don's life and five others. Learning the identity of that life-saving sailor and then making sure he was appropriately honored was a passionate quest of Don's, one which was fulfilled not long after we sat down with him in 2017. We're going to begin today with part of that conversation, starting with his memories of growing up during the Great Depression as one of four children in his family in Red Cloud, a town of a little more than 1,000 in south-central Nebraska.
It was tough days. That was a depression, and we lived hand-to-mouth, about. That was it.
Couldn't take anything for granted?
Not really, and you didn't have anything, jobs or anything. You didn't have any money. You couldn't buy anything. You couldn't do anything. You just existed.
So what does a kid growing up in those conditions dream about? What does a kid like that think he's going to do someday with his life?
Well, I don't think you think a hell of a lot about it. You just live from day to day, and you hope that you could be there the next day.
And not long after you finished high school, you decided to join Uncle Sam's Navy. What was that all about? I mean, I don't think you saw a whole lot of water in Red Cloud, Nebraska.
Well, that's just one of those things that you $21 a month, and it sounds like a lot of money, and no money around at that time. And right now, $21 an hour is not too bad, so you know what the difference is. I was just wanting to get somewhere where I could maybe do something with myself, and that was it. And the Navy looked like it.
Was it what you expected, or did you have a rude awakening?
Well, it was different. I mean, the boot camp was different, and all the things, and aboard ship was different. But you learn to live with it.
And your ship is a ship whose name everyone recognizes. Probably many of the people listening have been to pay respect to your ship and the 1,177 men who died aboard that ship on December 7th, 1941. But what can you tell me about the battleship USS Arizona before December 7th? You probably picked it up in Puget Sound?
Yeah, I did, and we went into dry dock there, and then we went to Hawaii. And then I was in a deck division, the 6th Division on the port side, and I and another seaman, Harl Nelson, we worked on the incinerator. I had to burn everything, and even at sea, in simulated war times or something, we even had to burn the garbage.
Burning the trash in the ship's incinerator.
And like 1,700 men, so that, you know, in the galley to feed them and that, whatever, a lot of people.
And you said your hometown had 1,500 people.
Right.
So this battleship's bigger than your hometown.
That's right.
What was that like? How'd you get along with those other guys?
Just like you got along with everybody else. You went through boot camp, and we just made do with what was available. And you had shipmates, and you had people that you didn't pay much attention to. And most generally, the deck division, the engineering division was segregated, and you didn't have much to do with them or anything else. And you paid attention to orders. That was about it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get a sense of your duties aboard the ship, but one aside, one of the stories I've become familiar with over the years by talking to friends of members of the band who were killed that day was the story of your ship's band. Every single member of that band was killed on December 7th, but they had been in a battle of the bands. Do you remember ever hearing or watching that band perform?
Oh, yes. They were on the fantail. They were actually there to perform Colors every morning for Colors, and they sound the battle stations, and they all were in the number two handling room, and most of them up around the big 14-inch guns, and they were all killed that day.
So many were, and you came close to it. Before that, though, what was your understanding of what your duties on this ship were going to be?
Well, we just wholly stoned the deck, and we clean sweep downs, and we've done a lot of chipping and painting, and salt water has a lot to do with that, so that was just an everyday occurrence.
And this story and December 7th has been a part of your life for so long now. There's so much that you know now that you didn't know then. You know why there are a lot of reasons people should have seen it coming, why there were things that happened that morning that could have tipped off the ships at Pearl Harbor. But did you have any idea before that Sunday morning that anything like this could even happen?
We never had nothing. That only thing we had that was an inkling of any kind was when we were at sea on maneuvers, where they were only allowed a 3-gallon bucket of water every day because they had evaporators, and it was just a trial thing, I know, and I knew there was something in the wind, so that's exactly what they was doing.
And I know that you have told this story so many times, and every time you do, you're honoring the memory of those 1,177 from the Arizona and the 2,400 Americans who died at Pearl that day. But how did you experience that morning? What's the first thing you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, it was nothing. It was just quarter for muster, and then we had chow, and then we had colors and whatever. So it was just a normal day for us.
So what was the first indication that it wasn't a normal day?
Well, it was just we had a little notice there, and they had the sound general quarters, and everybody was on duty, so here and there, and aboard ship, my battle station was a side setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and they small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
And how did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into 1,000,000 pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. And that just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there.
I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy. But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You try to figure out what to do. That's it.
Are you looking around? Are you watching what's happening? Are you closing your eyes and praying? I mean,
no, you're just trying to get out of the way from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here?
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on a heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burned. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who are on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most generally figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience. And
Where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they didn't. They got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of skin grafts and a lot of stuff, a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air.
Don Stratton went through an unthinkable ordeal on December 7th, 1941, not to mention the 10 months that followed before he finally emerged from the hospital. Think about the pain, the uncertainty, the devastation of losing so many. But part of what makes Don's story so powerful and inspirational is what he decided to do after his medical discharge from the Navy. We'll hear about that when we come back and hear some of the words shared about the late USS Arizona survivor whose body was carried home to Red Cloud, Nebraska this week. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myEECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.